All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Today we have another supplemental episode to Chapter 1. This time it's an interview with founding Mosaic and Netscape engineer John Middlehauser. John was responsible for the Windows version of both Mosaic and Navigator, and in fact rose to the position of product manager for Netscape Navigator itself. And if I could, a quick reminder that giving us a review on iTunes is the easiest way to support this podcast. So if you're enjoying these episodes, head over to iTunes, leave a short review of us, and thank you. And now without further ado, the interview with John Middlehauser. John Middlehauser, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
My pleasure.
So I always start off really simple. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Chicago area, a suburb called Naperville, sort of a bit of the high-tech hub in the Chicago area. It's where AT&T, Bell Labs, and all of that started or is in.
So that was an easy hop, skip, and a jump to the University of Illinois then.
Yeah, a bunch of my friends went there. So I was probably the local guy of the group, I guess. But yes, is the short answer.
I had read that you were a self-taught programmer, computer nerd.
Yeah, I was pretty much a geek from the start. You know, my dad had started his own companies, has been sort of an entrepreneur his whole life, and I grew up with that. And he brought home a computer very early, an Apple II, not a 2 Plus or a 2E, an Apple II, you know, all capital on the keyboard, used a, you know, cassette tape drive to load data. So talk about, you know, half an hour to load the most basic program. And basically, you know, brought that home when I was, you know, 8, 9, something like that, and got me interested in computers really early on.
So, are you at the NCSA during graduate school or when you were an undergrad?
Yeah, I was a graduate student. So I guess I might have started there as an undergraduate programmer, but when the, you know, relevant portion of this of the early web founding, I was a research assistant at NCSA.
Getting
my master's degree.
Do you remember your the first time you encountered the web?
Not specifically. So, you know, Eric Bina and Mark Andreessen basically came across the work that Tim had done, and they were Unix programmers at that point, so working on SGIs and Suns. Linux didn't exist yet. And, you know, basically had come across and thought it was cool. And they basically had started to write and did the Unix version of Mosaic. So, I mean, the first time I saw the web was actually, you know, Mark and Eric showing me what they had done. I never saw Tim's work directly or any of that. I saw Unix Mosaic, and you know, I said, that's cool, and decided, you know, myself and Chris Wilson decided to write the Windows version of Mosaic, and then Alex Todich wrote the Mac version. So it was, you know, a month or so after Mark and Eric had come across it, probably, because, they spent a couple of weeks.
Do they approach you to do a Windows port, or is it just something that you're just interested in, so you're like, hey, can I do a Windows port?
Yeah, it was, I mean, we were all just kids kind of hanging out in the basement of this, you know, what was called the software development group at NCSA, and, you know, it was more like, hey, that's cool, I want to do that. I didn't have a Unix box at my desk, so, I mean, to be honest, it's also just like, I want to be able to do it for myself. So, I mean, the project just started. The reason they did it was because they thought it was cool, and then, Chris and I wrote the Windows version because we thought it would be cool. And by that point, you know, they were getting a lot of interest already in the Unix version, but obviously the user base is, you know, was minuscule compared to the Windows user base. So, getting a version that would work on Windows was pretty key. I don't, know how technical you want me to get at this point, but, you know, the challenge at that point was that there wasn't a common networking library, what's called a sockets library on Windows. So, it wasn't until much later that Microsoft came out with the WinSock library. So at that point, you know, basically what you were writing was versions for particular network cards, which is sort of, you know, hard to imagine now, but it was like, you wrote a version that worked on a particular network card from, you know, a particular vendor, and made it work.
But it is the Windows version that, in a way, that's what really has Mosaic take off, because now, you know, the mainstream people can access the web for the first time, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's all exponential growth, obviously, from the start, but, you know, the Unix version had a very sort of academic usage pattern. You know, it was mostly people at schools and universities that had access, obviously, to higher-end machines, SGI, Suns, et cetera. The Windows version coming out, and the Mac to a lesser degree, was basically what led to the explosion of just sort of the common person who wasn't really, I mean, got it outside of the domain of computer scientists, basically.
Right.
And let, you know, just the average Joe start accessing the data, accessing the information that was available, and then obviously that, you know, was necessary for the explosive growth.
So it's just you and Chris Wilson working on the Windows version, and for each version, everyone's working independently. Like, so, you know, if you do a feature for Windows, is it true you're responsible for the hand icon, things like that?
Yeah.
So if you come up with a feature, does everyone else add it, or are you guys working together in terms of adding features and things like that?
Yes to all of it. So when we did Mosaic, the three versions were completely separate code bases. So the Unix version that they Mark and Eric had done, the Windows version, the Mac version were didn't share a single line of code. So you know, we would, you know, get together middle of the night and come up with some cool idea. Images was an example of that. And then we would go off and race and see who could do it first. Other times it was just, you know, one of the groups came up with some idea and did it. And, I mean, to answer your, did the other groups do it? I mean, the short answer is if they thought it was a good idea. So, you know, it was really, really easy to change the icon on Windows. I mean, it was just a single call. And so I'm like, you know, oh, when it goes over a hyperlink, you know, it's sort of Windows standard. You change to, you know, the hand icon to indicate you can click on it. So, I mean, that was, you know, 5 minutes of work, right? And then, of course, you know, that forced the other, you know, Unix and everybody else to go do it because it was a good idea and it was popular. Wasn't necessarily as easy on their platform. So, and there was often a, you know, sort of the competitive aspect of trying to come up with the cool thing, get it done first, et cetera, et cetera. I know, you know, the the Wikipedia talks about the fact that I saw an image in a web page first, and that wasn't, you know, that was somewhat coincidence, and just the fact that we came up, we said, hey, we should put embedded images. It was a highly requested thing. And it was really easy, again, to do in Windows, because Windows had this technology called object linking and embedding. So prior to images being embedded, basically the way it worked was everything was text. You could put a link in there. You clicked on it, and it would bring up a separate program to view the image.
Right.
Well, in Windows, it was really easy to say, well, take that separate program and just put it embedded inside my program. You know, we didn't actually write image viewing code at that point in Mosaic. We just embedded the built-in program to view it. So, you know, it was really quick and easy for me to do that first, which was kind of cool.
So X Mosaic was not the first to support images. It was the Windows Mosaic.
In terms of our internal, now I have no memory of which, you know, got released to an external use first. But, you know, it was basically us deciding to build. This is my memory, and I gave you a caveat before we started recording that it's 20 years ago. It's hard to believe. I can't swear to it, but that my belief is, yes, that that we had the Windows internally first showed it. The images was definitely an idea, was one of the ones that as a group we talked about and we came up with how to do, and then we went off and we raced to see who could do it first. The Unix version tended to release updates publicly faster than the other version, so it may very well be that that version went public first, for example. You know, I'm sure you... I unfortunately didn't get a chance to listen to your interviews with Alex and Lou prior, but I'm guessing you got into some of the history of sort of the inherent conflict or attitudinal difference, shall we say, between sort of the Mosaic group and Lou and sort of the original guys like Tim Berners-Lee and the founders. Images is kind of the classic example of caused a lot of sort of angst in the early web community because we just went and decided this was a cool thing and decided to put them in.
Did you attend that first web conference in Massachusetts?
Yes, yeah, I did. So
and so they're kind of they're a little aggravated at you guys for adding that at that point?
Yes, is the short answer. You know, for those that don't have the context, I mean, I would basically characterize it as, you know, Tim and those guys had a very sort of European academic attitude, really wanted some philosophical things to be inherent. And we were more pragmatic and wanted to put in what people wanted. So images was an example. So, you know, to be specific, one of the things Tim felt very strongly about, and I love as a theory, is that the data and the presentation were completely separate. And so basically the content of the web pages was completely separate from how it displayed. And then it could display on any device, it could display on anything. So in that world, you don't worry about putting images in because images, you know, as soon as you put an image in, then the designer wants control over where to put it, right? I mean, that now you look at web pages and obviously, you know, we had a very pragmatic view and, you know, I would say that time has shown it to be correct that for it to be successful, it needed to have this capability. And, you know, it was one of those sort of things that caused explosion because everything up to that point was just sort of, you know, text on a page, right? And it's when you start adding in, you know, multimedia content, you know, videos and images, you didn't really have much in the way of videos at that point, you know, that it just, you know, we're humans. That is much more interesting things to look at than a page of text.
Right. Can you describe a bit the relationship with the NCSA, because, you know, this project takes off. It wasn't necessarily an assigned project, even though it obviously fits their purview of what they're doing, but you guys kind of do this on your own, and then now it explodes. So what happens then when the NCSA notices that this is, you know, taking off?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, it was a side project that we did kind of, you know, separate from what we were, you know, our major assignments as students. I mean, the short version is once it took off and started getting a bunch of public, you know, notice, first it became our official project, which was a good thing. And then second, over time, and this is where it started to, and has been documented, cause conflict, it, you know, in kind of sort of classic bureaucracy, other people started getting assigned to it, and then other people started getting assigned to manage it and to run the project. And you know, obviously, this was a project that we felt passionately about at this point. We had created and you know, believed that we knew what we wanted to do next, and we had our own goals and we had our own things that we thought were important. And those weren't necessarily aligned with, you know, what NCSA as an organization wanted or the people who were all of a sudden put in charge. So, you know, we found, you know, in effect, it was kind of control was taken away. And this is, you know, over the course of a year and a half, 2 years, control was taken away and influence was taken away. So, you know, that obviously is part of what led us off to go start up Netscape.
Right. And yeah, people start to leave. Chris Wilson goes to Spry, and Mark goes out to California to do whatever. And then, so how do you, everyone said that you sort of kept in touch with Mark, but how does he tell you he's coming back? Does he tell you he's coming back with Jim Clark? Does he tell you what the project's going to be, or?
He says, yeah, so this was almost, we actually had kind of a mini reunion a couple weeks ago when we were trying to figure out the exact date. It was some point in early April, so almost exactly 20 years ago. Mark basically sends mail, says, hey, I met, you know, Jim Clark, he's a cool guy, he's looking to start up a company, and I'm talking with him about what we should do. And then, you know, at that point, Jim was very interested in doing sort of interactive TV. So he was trying to convince Mark to go do interactive TV. And the more they talked about it, this is obviously how it's characterized to me, you know, the more Mark basically just said, you know, what we really should do is go do Mosaic Right, do a Mosaic Killer. And, you know, basically got Jim around to that point of view over, you know, the course of March. And then so, you know, at the beginning of April, Mark sends a mail saying, hey, Jim and I are flying out to meet with you guys. And at this point, I'm in my second year of my master's thesis, my master's degree, planning to take sort of, I'm finishing classes that mid-May, and planning to take the summer off, kind of do my thesis and graduate at the end of the summer and then figure out what the heck I'm going to do with my life. Instead, they fly out mid-April. Jim meets with us all basically at a hotel where he's staying, the bar at the hotel. Mm-hmm. Faxes himself offer letters to us and offers us jobs to start up the company that became Netscape. It was kind of a no-brainer to say yes. I mean, here you're gonna, you know, I'm gonna pay you to go work on the project that you want to go work on, and give you guys control and the chance to redo it right. Because, you know, by that point, anybody who's done software projects knows that, you know, by the time you've worked on it for a year or two, you realize, oh my God, if I had done, you know, all these things differently, it would be so much better. If you have the opportunity to start over from scratch and rewrite, it's a way better product. And we had that opportunity. It was great.
Yeah, I definitely see that, but I've said to everyone so far, I mean, it is still kind of a leap. You know, now it's, you know, it's a cultural trope that, you know, kids leave college and run out to California to make their fortune, but, you know, you guys, you kind of started that template, so it is kind of a leap to, all right, you left the master's program uncompleted, right?
Well, no, actually. So that was, you know, around April 15th, I signed the offer letter and wrote a thesis in 2 weeks and turned it in and flew out here and we started up Netscape on May 2nd. And then about 2 weeks, and I had basically completed my classwork, all the tests and stuff. So as far as I know, and I did, you know, I did verify this at one point. I graduated, but I was out here working, you know, 120 hour weeks when my actual graduation ceremony should have happened. So no, I did complete the thesis and get it done. In terms of it being a leap, you know, I think, as I mentioned, my dad was entrepreneurial and had started companies. It had always been kind of my style. It's the classic. Classic geek story, right? I mean, I had started companies when I was, you know, 12 years old, teaching people how to program, teaching adults how to program or how to use a computer. I had started a computer rental business. So for me, it had always been my goal to, you know, I think if you would pin me down at that point, I would have said, I'm going to go get a job for a while, get some experience, and then go start a company. But it was definitely what I wanted to do. So I think I was the easiest sell, and was actually the first. It was somewhat random what order we went up, but part of it was, you know, I was the first of that group to go up and sign the offer letter, and that was just because I really had no doubt. It was, you know, here's a good salary. None of us understood things about stock options or any of that, and you know, I'm guessing the other guy said this to you, but you know, I have so much respect for Jim Clark at this point, because you know, he could have screwed all of us over and we would never have known, and he truly did well by us, you know, and treated us the way, you know, I hope other companies are treating their founding engineers at this point, and you know, really did make, you know, make us founders of that company, as opposed to sort of, you know, slave labor he was taking advantage of. So right. that was a, you know, he was the experienced guy out here. We were a bunch of kids. We wouldn't have known any better, right?
Mm-hmm. So whether it was slave labor or not, you are, you know, starting up, hitting the ground running, working 120 hour weeks, sleeping under your desk and that sort of thing. Alex described it that, you know, you don't know anybody out in California. You're all young, single guys. So, you know, you don't have lives outside of work anyway. Why not?
There was nothing else to do, right? Yeah.
That's,
I mean, the only people we knew were the guys we were working with and having fun with. And yeah, I mean, I literally had an apartment building, or an apartment in the building that was kind of attached to our office. I lived the closest, you know, I didn't often bother putting shoes on to go up to work. And, really dating myself here, but you know, 900 megahertz cordless phone from my house or my apartment reached the office space. So basically I could take my cordless phone, you know, which did not have much range at that point. This wasn't a half mile range phone, up, and there weren't really mobile phones, so that weren't the size of a, you know, small, bigger than my iPad these days practically. You know, I could take that up to the office, and you know, like you said, there was nothing else to do. So, we didn't know other people. You know, I would work all day, go to dinner with those guys, go back. You know, we're software guys, right? We tend to work through the middle of the night. So, you know, go to bed at 3, wake up at 10. If I was lucky, go for a swim or try and do something for exercise and go back to work and repeat 7 days a week. It was fun. I couldn't do it now. Now I'm an old man, but.
Right. I was going to say, like, when you look back on that now, do you feel like, wow, I can't believe we were even capable of that? Or it's just youth, I guess.
It's just youth, yeah. I mean, now I'm the gray beard who, you know, manages guys like that and gals like that. And it's, you know, it's a lot of energy, not always, you know, well applied. So there's the balance of, you know, the energy and the wisdom. And hopefully as you lose some of the energy, you gain some of the wisdom and learn how to work, you know, more effectively and get the right stuff done.
Let me seg then into what is the marching orders are to do Mosaic, but to do it right this time. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, do it right and do it with an eye of commercial usage, which is a different, you know, a different lens to look at the project. You know, basically Mosaic was definitely done just as kind of a hobby, fun little thing. You know, the three versions were all different code bases. They had different bugs. They had a lot of bugs. you know, it didn't really matter. You were just throwing it out there, and if it worked, it worked. If it didn't work, you fixed and you threw another one out. But you know, when you start, we started up. It was originally named Mosaic Communications, and then the name was later changed to Netscape. You know, the first thing we did is basically sit down and say, well, if we're going to make a company out of this, a commercial product out of this, what do we have to do differently? And you
can't use any of the old code. You've got to start from scratch in terms
we
of...
We didn't. I mean, that was the funny thing is, yeah, there was the conflict you probably got into where, you know, we were originally accused of taking the code, and then we said, no, we haven't taken a line of code. And we were audited and, of course, proven that we didn't. But, I mean, we didn't want to take any of the code. That's the thing, is we wanted to start from scratch. We wanted to do it right. There wasn't any code that we wanted to take. So that was the really easy answer of, no, we didn't. Look at how it works much, much better. Obviously, it's not the same code base. So we sat down and, you know, came up. Mark basically drove a lot of that discussion. And I'm trying to remember what all the items were, but one was obviously a shared code base between the three versions, which was pretty much unheard of at that point in time, that you'd have Mac, Windows, and you know Unix all sharing a code base. And then the biggest other thing was the invention of SSL, and that was basically, if this is going to be a commercial product, we have to do some level, we have to come up with how to make it secure, such that people can use it for things like putting a credit card in and shopping and business and you know all the stuff that people use it for today. And those were, you know, fast was the other. So we had realized as we worked on it that there were a lot of things that we had done wrong in terms of how we had written Mosaic, and that we could get, you know, at least a 10x perceived speed you know, improvement in redoing it, and we did, and that was, you know, as soon as we released sort of the first beta of Netscape, it pretty much just took off, and everybody switched over to it, and most of that was the perceived speed difference. You know, you don't really learn the stability until over time, and it was way better than Mosaic. It was still a internet early product that had issues. But
is it fully cross platform when you finally launch?
So it was cross platform from the lowest layer up to a certain point, and then there was a platform specific library for the three platforms, or technically it was even more than three platforms. So there was basically a front end layer for 16-bit Windows, 32-bit Windows, Macintosh, and then various, I believe all the Unix flavors were sort of one front-end platform at that point. So all of sort of the networking call libraries, all of, you know, the HTTP parsing, HTML, layout engine, all of that was sort of shared code base. When it came to actually displaying, you know, a window on the screen or displaying an image or, you know, a menu to do things, that was sort of, by definition, platform-specific code. So we basically did an abstraction layer and just, you know, created a, you know, call a, you know, throw up your menu, and then the Windows did it a certain way, and Mac did it a certain way, and Unix did it a certain way below that.
Well, and one of the other things that you guys get to innovate that I don't think people, you know, would think about now, but, you know, you're the first generation of people that can throw out betas and get feedback right away, and you know you keep churning out new versions because you don't have to, you know, ship it on a CD-ROM or something and wait 6 weeks for feedback, and you know you guys can iterate almost in real time, right?
Yeah, I mean that was huge, and we started that obviously with Mosaic, where you know you'd have turns within a day of, you know, somebody finds an issue and you immediately fix it. you know, the classic sort of software at that point was probably on, you know, a 2-year release cycle, where, you know, commercial software, new versions, I mean, it's sort of, you still see it with operating systems now, right? For the most part. And, you know, that was the way software was done. And you know, as you say, the biggest problem with that is you get very limited feedback. You're pretty much done with the product by the time you get feedback, whereas, you know, kind of the internet development style that obviously is prevalent now with a lot of things is and there's all the buzzwords of agile and various things, but you know what it really comes down to is a quicker cycle with more feedback earlier on so that you can adjust your path and figure out, you know, what's working, what the, you know, at the end of the day, the whole point of software obviously is that the end user is getting a benefit out of it. And if the end user is not touching it and telling you what they want and what's working and what's not, it's hard to measure that.
You mentioned SSL, which, you know, I think you guys also deserve credit for not making that proprietary. Although I guess the argument would be if you want it to be accepted widely, then you have to throw it out there for everyone to use. But, I mean, you guys also, you know, you adopted Java, you started to allow plugins early on and things like that. So you guys are developing the software, but you're also allowing, you know, the community to add on and any new innovation, if it's a good innovation, you guys incorporate it, right?
Yeah, you know, I now open source is kind of the label for all of that, but we were definitely philosophically sort of pioneers in that, in the sense that and we had to work hard to convince Jim Clark and some of the other guys from Silicon Valley of the value of this, because, you know, there was obviously a question of you're doing all this, but you're publishing it all and anybody else can go do it as well. And, you know, arguably that is what Microsoft did eventually. But it's really what led to a lot of the explosive growth and a lot of the capabilities. And it was something philosophically that we all felt fairly strongly about at that point. So we didn't patent any of the original ideas. We didn't, you know, in hindsight, because patents are mostly used defensively, we probably should have, but we didn't know that at that point. You know, it was something that we felt strongly about and believed that this could explode and that there were a lot of ways that you could make, you know, a very successful business out of it. And obviously, that's been proven extremely true over time. I mean, search being the biggest example or the most obvious example, unfortunately, wasn't one that Netscape as a company tackled. But, you know, Google or started with Yahoo and then Google and sort of that second generation of web plays clearly have shown how you could make a very, very, very successful business out of the technologies.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is sort of an aside, but it does occur to me that, you know, you guys, you described you had to talk Jim Clark into leaving this stuff open and some of the Silicon Valley people. It occurs to me that was so much of the ethos of the early internet is, you know, that collaborative, open, you know, the whole Tim Berners-Lee design the web to be collaborative and open and not be, you know, closed standards based and stuff like that. And that's, you know, that sort of at the beginning is responsible for the exponential success. But I kind of feel like that's been lost in the last decades or so.
I don't think it has. I think it has shifted somewhat. where you see it now is, you know, how much sort of foundational technology there is to build a business, build a product. So, you know, back when we were doing this, you know, there was nothing. You know, if you were starting a software project, you started with a blank screen. You know, now, and well, you started by going to Fry's and buying a server, and, you know, trying to get an OS installed on it, and then a compiler, and then a blank screen, and then you start writing code. You know, there is just now, if you want to write a mobile app, or if, you know, you can have something up and running in, you know, less than an hour. I mean, you spin up instances on AWS and use this library and that foundational piece and this foundational piece, and all of those sort of building blocks didn't exist back then. And I really think that's the new form of sort of the openness is you know, jQuery and all of these things that, you know, all kinds of products are built on top of that are open source foundational pieces that didn't exist. You know, one of the interesting things about when Netscape founded was, you know, Silicon Valley to some degree was stagnating. I mean, there were big companies out here, the HPs and the SGIs and the Suns and the Oracles and those, but there wasn't that much interesting innovation. There weren't a ton of little startups. I mean, as you say, writing software was hard. So most of Silicon Valley tended to be hardware, and hardware is a long development cycle. It worked great for Netscape because what it meant was that, and I didn't recognize this until, you know, it's easy in hindsight to see 20 years later, but I had no frame of reference. We attracted the most amazing talent because we were something interesting and hot. So, you know, the best of the best of Silicon Valley, it was kind of sitting around going, what the heck should I work on? All kind of magnetically were drawn to Netscape because it was this buzz, interesting new world opening up. I joke about sort of relative versus absolute scales. And, you know, this is my first job. I'm 24 out of college. And you work with folks and you come up with sort of this scale, right? Oh, that's an A player and that's a B player and that's a C player. And it's just natural, you know, it's natural way you think of things. And, you know, after I left Netscape and I went to another company, and I started to realize that, you know, my scale at Netscape was sort of a relative scale, and on an absolute scale, you know, those C players at Netscape were easily A players, you know, in the world as a whole or the valley as a whole. I mean, there were people who I was like, God, I could never work with this guy, and, you know, two or three companies later, I'm like, you know, I'd kill to have that guy as my CEO over the one I have, right? You know. Mm-hmm. And it was that sort of draw of, you know, all of the top talent, all the interesting people ended up there. So if you look at sort of the tree of Netscape in terms of all the companies that have come since, either directly or indirectly, and obviously things like, you know, Andreessen Horowitz and all those, it's easy to trace that tree. But, you know, Ram Shriram wrote one of the first checks for Google, and, you know, he was a guy on the sales side I used to fly around with all the time, being sort of the geek in the room. And there's just, you know, there's 100 of those stories of, you know, people who have become VCs and people who have started this company or done that. And it's really, I think a lot of the legacy is that as much as anything of the tree of companies and technologies that have spun out afterwards.
Some of the feedback I've gotten from people that, you know, had never even heard of Mosaic and maybe had heard of Netscape and stuff like that. Did you become basically the project manager of Navigator as it went forward?
Yeah, so I started for 1.0. I ran the Windows team and was basically the Windows engineer, myself and a guy, Chris Houck, who came from NCSA, although he hadn't worked on Mosaic with us. And then basically, the short version is I got talked into being the first product manager for 2.0 as well. I joked that, you know, I made the mistake of letting them know I could talk about the product as well as write it. And what we had run into was, you know, nobody knew what this was. You know, we were spending all of our time explaining, you know, what is the internet and, you know, where's the server, you know, the server, right, for the web. And you know, so I, you know, obviously fundamentally understood what was going on and was able to communicate. So moved over and was product manager for sort of the 2.0 effort. And you mentioned plugins in Java and JavaScript, and that was really that was the time frame we added it. So as the product manager, I kind of led what I think of as, to use the current buzzword, is the platformization of the web. So
that was exactly what I wanted you to talk about. For people that maybe never use Navigator, can you talk some about, you know, Navigator adds news groups, adds an email client, you know, can you talk about that, turning Navigator into a software platform of its own?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best examples of that are JavaScript and to a lesser degree Java, because it took Java a fair amount of time to get traction. But JavaScript was an extremely conscious effort on our part to add in, you know, a client-side language that let people to do things that we had never thought of before in the browser. So the earliest example of this was Forms, and I guess you talked with Lou about this because Lou was, you know, one of the sort of creators of Forms. And for people who don't know what I mean by Forms, Forms are basically, you know, the widgets you interact with to fill out information. So, you know, when you're filling out your address and your credit card and there's a text entry field, that's in HTML parlance, or at least HTML 1.0 parlance, those were Forms. Before Forms, the web was a one-way street. I mean, it was an information viewer, but there was no way basically to send information back to the server. So we added Forms and saw this explosion of people doing things that, you know, oh, if I can put a text field in and ask for something, then I can kind of dynamically change what I return to them. And there was this absolute explosion of creation of things that, you know, we had never imagined people doing, and saw the value of that, and so decided, you know, we need to do it in the next generation of that. And that was sort of where the origins of the idea, department of redundancy department there, but the origins of JavaScript, you know, was let's put a language in that lets people interactively change the page based on what, you know, on logic, on programming, and Java, and then plugins was the other, was, you know, we were getting all kinds of people saying, oh, can you add the capability for this type of image or this viewer, and Adobe obviously was like, well, can you change to PDF from HTML, and our solution for this was, rather than doing a bunch of custom programming, we're going to do an interface and let anybody put stuff in, and I think, again, that was one of those key decisions that kind of led to the next level of exponential growth. And there's, you know, you can point to sort of those milestones all through the project. Each one caused this sort of explosion of, and it's content driven. It's what the guy at the other end could say, oh wow, with this capability, I can make this, you know, server that does this amazing thing. And then somebody else sees that and, you know, takes it to their domain. So, you know, it's enabling again that user, and in that case, the user is the content creator. It's the guy who's wants to put up, you know, information. He's, you know, a fan of some TV show, and he wants to make a web page that all about that TV show that all of a sudden has all this content. And it was just that, you know, I think the other thing folks today don't necessarily appreciate, and this was one of the things that was really nice about HTML, was anybody could write HTML. There weren't, you know, editing programs at that point. You opened up VI or Notepad and you wrote HTML, and it was the simplicity of it kind of opened it up for everybody. I'm bouncing all over the place. But.
No, that's perfect. Do you have any memories of specifically the IPO, or that the time around the IPO?
I have a couple memories of the day. You know, we didn't, again, you know, we're young, we're not all that business savvy. There was, you know, I at that point was on the product side, so I was doing sort of interviews going in and had a better feel for how much buzz there was. But, you know, it just was kind of this ton of, you know, energy that day, and obviously, we were supposed to open at a certain price in the morning, and then the price doubled, and then it just nothing happened, and we were all like, what is going on? And then it finally opened, you know, way, way higher than originally, and it was exciting, and we, you know, yelled and screamed and all that stuff, and then an hour later we were back to work, because, you know, none of us really understood what was going on, and it was, all of us had something we were in the middle of doing, so, you know, I think you still see it in Silicon Valley. The successful companies, the successful products are the ones that the people doing them have the passion for the product, and they're doing it, you know, as I said, now I'm kind of the graybeard executive management type guy, and, you know, the companies that I see succeed are the ones that are doing it because they strongly believe and they enjoy what they're doing, and that's kind of what everybody was, you know, who was working on it at that point was feeling.
So after the IPO, you already were the hot thing in Silicon Valley, and you know now all the attention's on you, and right away Microsoft's attentions are on you. When I spoke to Chris Wilson, he talked about the IE team having a sense of competitiveness with you guys in terms of coming out with new features and you know, our version is faster than your previous version and that sort of thing. Did you guys feel a sense of competition? When do you feel Microsoft turning their attentions towards you is my real question.
Certainly when they started coming out with IE, there was direct competition. Yeah. I mean, there was competition of features and speed and user base, you know, what percent of people are using what. But, you know, the funny thing about us and Microsoft was from day one, people would ask who our competition was, and, you know, our answer pretty much was Microsoft at that point. And people would look at us like we're crazy. I mean, first off, you're 20 guys, and, you know, they don't have any clue what the web was. But, you know, we sort of fundamentally understood that if we succeeded, that, you know, we were going to be in their crosshairs. And then, you know, the fact is, and they were the 800-pound gorilla, and anybody who succeeded was in their crosshairs. I mean, it there wasn't a product category in software that existed that, you know, if you succeeded, Microsoft was your competition. I mean, if you were doing a spreadsheet or a word processor or you name it, I mean, then they had pretty much, you know, innovated, conquered, et cetera, every space there was by that point. So it was easy to see that if we succeeded, Microsoft was going to be our competition. And it really wasn't until that second and third generations of companies, especially Google's come along, that's not necessarily the case anymore. And, you know, Netscape wasn't the company that kind of broke that monopoly, but at least we laid the groundwork, so.
Right. You weren't in upper management or anything like that, but looking back on it, do you feel like Netscape could have done anything differently, especially in the browser wars or anything like that?
You know, hindsight's 20/20. You can come up with little things that I would certainly have done differently. Fundamentally, I don't know that any of it would have mattered. I mean, so there was always this perception that we gave away the product for free, and it just isn't true. Netscape was free for non-commercial use. That was the license agreement. We had, you know, teams of people sitting around looking. The nice thing about Netscape, it was a really easy sales for these guys. We called them the net sales team. And basically, you know, Netscape, when you started it up, went to our homepage. And so we could look at our server logs and we could tell who was coming in and using the browser. And these guys, literally, guys and gals, literally would look through those logs and go, oh, Oracle has, you know, 20,000 people using it, would call up the IT guy at Oracle and say, you got 20,000 unlicensed copies, you owe us, you know, X dollars. And we were making millions of dollars off of browser. And, you know, you run into a company that has billions of dollars of cash, your millions of dollars doesn't do you much good when they say, okay, we're just going to give away this product for free. So, you know, in terms of the browser itself, you know, if you have a competitor who can outspend you and give it away for free, you're kind of doomed. You know, fundamentally, Netscape as a company, could they have succeeded? Of course. I mentioned search earlier. You know, we tackled a lot of areas trying to find where the business was. We tackled, you know, a lot of server technologies that still exist and made good money off of them. We tried to tackle sort of content, but our view of content was more, you know, the homepage content, newspaper. We're gonna be the point where all the information comes, and we're gonna make ad revenue. Had Netscape, you know, the Yahoo guys were in a cube a couple of, you know, cubes away from me, basically incubated in our office, and, you know, we easily could have bought them and integrated them. Frankly, I'm not sure, given sort of the cultural, you know, way Netscape thought about things, that would have worked and be good for them. I'm sure they're very happy we didn't.
I think that an offer might have been made at some point. I've read there's suggestions that was made.
It was made, but it was a small enough offer that they easily were able to pass on it. I mean, we could have made them an offer they couldn't have passed on, right? Mm-hmm. If so, in hindsight, could you have come up with ways that the company could have succeeded? Of course. You know, you could have become Amazon, you could have become whatever, right? But the browser itself, which is where, you know, obviously my end of the world, I don't know how you could have ever competed with somebody who could outspend you, double, you know, put twice as many people on it and give it away for free. You just can't build a business out of that, right?
Mm-hmm. When did you end up leaving Netscape? Was it before the AOL purchase?
Yeah, I left in 98, sort of mid to late 98. So, yeah, I mean, it was pre-AOL acquisition. To be honest, by the time I left, I just thought the writing was on the wall. I mean, Microsoft had kind of, it had won the war. And, you know, I in hindsight, I'm very impressed with Barksdale pulling sort of the rabbit out of the hat and managing to sell the company off to AOL at that point.
Well, I'd like to wrap up a little bit with what I like to think of as my Barbara Walters question, which is, A, you know, it's 20 years on. Can you believe it's 20 years? And B, when you look at what the web and the internet has become, is it what you imagined 20 years ago? Has it not lived up to what you imagined? Has it gone beyond what you imagined?
No, I can't even begin to think it's 20 years. It's mind-blowing. I mean, obviously, we're doing these interviews, and we have a reunion planned in May, and so I keep getting sort of slapped in the face with the fact that it's 20 years.
My apologies.
that's fine. It doesn't feel like that. I mean, there's so much innovation, so many interesting things. It still feels like we're sort of on the upslope of that technology growth. But then I look back and I realize, you know, I'm significantly older than kind of the guys I thought were the old guys who were managing us, the guys who had come out of SGI. And, you know, now I'm in the role or senior to the role that they were in at that point. And I've got kids and I've got almost a teenager at this point. So it's hard to escape the fact it's 20 years. In terms of did it become what I thought, you know, none of us could have imagined the complete, you know, how much it's permeated everyday life. We definitely talked about, you know, shopping and travel and all these use cases. And I think we actually thought much bigger than anybody would believe, you know, and so the fact that I can buy almost anything online and the fact that I can get almost any piece of information online, that was all stuff I did imagine as we went through it. I would say, and since you characterize this sort of a Barbara Walters question, this is appropriate. The thing I didn't take into account that the web, and to me is sort of fundamentally something I'm really, I guess, proud of, was how it would influence the world and specifically sort of politics and people. And I'm thinking of kind of the Arab Spring and as a particular example of the web becoming sort of pervasive everywhere has led to sort of information being free, and I think has led to and is leading to sort of social changes faster than I could have ever imagined. And, you know, pick a subject, whether it's something as fundamental as the Arab Spring or particular sort of, you know, policy things in this country like gay marriage or marijuana legalization. I mean, I think sort of exposure to information, exposure to ideas, and you know, the generations growing up now, they're not limited whether, you know, they're growing up in the Deep South or they're growing up in, you know, Pakistan. They're not limited to the information that's being presented to them from 10 miles away, you know, or the circle of 10 miles. And I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. That, you know, that changing the world aspect never occurred to me and is sort of the fundamental thing that I'm sort of most proud of that's come out of the stuff we did.
Well, John Middlehauser, congratulations on 20 years, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.